Yeah, thank you very much. So I'm going to introduce myself. So first of all, I would like to thank organizers that invited me again to this beautiful place and gave me also opportunity once again to see some of the friends, either from France or from other countries, which is more difficult to see back home than here overseas. So I'm a geneticist, and I'm interested in DNA repair and stress responses, and finally in bacterial evolution. So when you think about evolution, and from my perspective, because I'm DNA repair guy, so DNA, the first thing that comes to mind is mutations. And why to be at all interested in mutations? It's because at the basis of most evolutionary processes, not all, of course, is genetic variability. And genetic variability is primarily produced by mutations and then subsequently rearranged by recombination. So now it's quite intuitive to say that when the adaptation is limited by supply of mutations, then high mutation rate can be adaptive. Now this classical vision on evolution mutation rates is somewhat contested by several observations. So I would go slowly, and then some things are maybe a little bit simplified, and sometimes maybe even a little bit too more complicated for example physicists, so don't hesitate to interrupt me in order to ask more precisions. So now I said mutation rates, and we know that most mutations that are generated, newly arising mutations, are deleterious, and people have measured this. But also this is one of the reasons why mutation rates are very low, and organisms invest huge amounts of energy in order to maintain mutation rates very low. So I'll give you one example, and this is the fidelity of DNA replication. So in order to maintain fidelity of DNA replication, there are many levels of control. The first one is that DNA that is going to be replicated must be in perfect physical and chemical shape. That means you have dozens of different DNA repair mechanisms that eliminate all or damages. Then the second level is maintain. These are the building blocks for the DNA. This is a pool of nucleotides. And nucleotides must also be completely in good shape. That means all that are damaged must be eliminated. For example, one of the most powerful mutagen, which is endogenous one, is one in which is oxidized at position 8. So this, why this nucleotide is so mutagenic? Because simply DNA polymerase is pairing this oxidized guanine with adenine or cytosine with the same probability. So, and the result is, of course, mutation. And there is a protein which is eliminating this type of molecules from the pool of nucleotides, which is called MUTC. So many proteins that are involved in control of mutation rates are called MUT, simply because the geneticists, when they inactivated those genes, observed that there is a huge increase of mutation rates. So for example, this particular molecule is eliminated by a protein called MUTT. And if you don't have this protein, then mutation rates for this particular type of mutations goes up thousandfold. Now, because this is something which is happening in all living cells, this protein is conserved from bacteria to humans. It's a very important protein. Now, this is not the only one which is cleaning the pool of nucleotides out of damaged nucleotides. Now, there is another level of control. And this is very important protein complex, which we call replicative DNA polymerases. They have two major activities which are controlling replication fidelity. One is to choose the right base. So Watson must be always paired with a kick. And this is increasing, this base selectivity is increasing fidelity replication 10 to the power 5 or 10 to the power 6 fold. And then, I mean, nothing is perfect, of course, and replicative DNA polymerases are also introducing mutations. So up to 4 nucleotides, they can stop, go backwards. And then with their proofreading activity, they can eliminate some of the mistakes. And this is increasing the fidelity replication further 20 to 200 fold. Now, even DNA polymerases are not absolutely perfect, and they are sometimes mispairing nucleotides. So these mispaired, or it can be also unpaired, if you have small loops here, are called mismatches. Now, these structures, so they are not Watson and Crick. They are recognized by post-replicative mismatch repair repair pathways, and they correct the activity of this mismatch repair pathway by increasing the fidelity of replication 200 to 400 times. Now, if you add all these different levels of control of fidelity of DNA replication, and then you ask what is the error rate per recuperation of a nucleotide, you arrive at error rate per recuperation of nucleotide is about 10 to power minus 10 per base. So this is something absolutely amazing, how this machinery is perfect or nearly perfect. And one of the more reasons is that you probably don't see what is written down there. But what is amazing is that, for example, this was calculated for E. coli. And E. coli have a genome which is about 4.7 megabases. So that means that you have no mutations per replication of a genome. So this is one of the reasons I told you. There is a huge investment in the maintenance of fidelity of DNA replication and dozens of different DNA repair mechanisms in order to keep mutation rates as low as possible. Now I will have I'll just zoom on these mismatches because I will come back to this repair mechanism afterwards. So I told you these are the non-Watson-Crick pairings. Now the problem with non-Watson-Crick pairings is that they are not damaged bases. If you have a damaged base, for example, if it is oxidized, alkylated, or broken, this is a signal for the enzymes, for example, glycosylases, in order to recognize the damaged base and remove it. So it's relatively easy to enzyme to recognize what is damaged. But these two bases are not damaged. They're in perfect shape. So this is a problem. And that's why, although the mismatches by themselves can be recognized, and the proteins which are recognizing mismatches are called mutase, and because also mismatches are something that arise in all organisms that have DNA as genetic material, mutase is conserved from the bacteria to humans. Now, this interaction is stabilized with another protein called mutel, and those two proteins are evolutionarily conserved. Now, what is different is, as I told you, to distinguish which base is wrong and which base is correct. The problem is that they are all perfectly in good shape. Now, per definition, the wrong base is newly synthesized DNA. That's why this complex must recognize and discriminate between newly synthesized strand and old strand. Now, I'm going to discuss only the example of E. coli, and so how E. coli is resolving this problem. On genome or on E. coli, there are nucleotides, I mean different composition, and you have GATC sequences. And these adenines in GATC sequences are methylated. Now, this methylation you can see, you know, in all strands. But immediately after replication, those methylases are a little bit slow. So you have a short period of time, short window of time, while these adenines in GATC sequences are not methylated. So the result is that you have hemimethylated DNA. So what's happening here is the mutel is polymerizing until reaching these hemimethylated GAT sequences, and this protein, which is endonuclease, cuts only this strand. When this strand is cut, then there is a classical repair process. That means helicase is removing this strand, exonucleases are degrading, and then you have a resynthesis. Now, you see how much, even for the single DNA repair process, how many proteins are involved in repair. But this is so efficient that this mismatch repair system is eliminating 99% of replication errors. Now, what is sorry, it's a little bit late, it's a little bit slow. So it's very difficult to imagine that if you inactivate this mismatch repair system, for example, if you inactivate mutase or mutated genes, that we know from the laboratory that mutation rates goes up 100-fold for the substitution mutation, or 1,000 or 10,000-fold for the small frame shift in microsatellite sequences. So there is a huge increase of mutation rates. And for a long time, it was thought that such mutants cannot be selected for or even present in the nature. Now, this is one old figure that I'm showing as illustration of this over and over. Whenever you have problems with theoretical or experimental data, the only way to resolve it is to go back to the nature. So what we did, and some other labs also, is simply went to nature and then took natural isolates, take them back to the laboratory, and then measure mutation rates under identical environmental conditions. So what you see, these are the mutation rates, and this is simply 70 different natural isolates. Yes?
It's per gene, right? So how long is this gene?
Sorry, this is per gene, which is about kilobase.
Okay.
And the mutations in this gene, which is RPOB gene, which is causing for this one subunit of RNA polymerase, which is very convenient because mutations are giving resistance to one antibiotic.
The median line here is would be something like even less than 10 to the power minus 10, which often is.
Yeah, okay, but yeah, you go down to the per nucleotide, okay? So what you obtain from this gene is about 2 10 to the power minus 8. Okay. Now, this is the median. I mean, and what you observe when you look for the distribution, then you see that some of them are mutating 10-fold more than the median, and some are mutating even 100-fold more than the median. And this is something that was observed also before, but not completely unexpected. And according to theory, those strains are not even expected to be present in nature. And then we identified also why those mutants, which are natural mutants, why they are mutating so much. And they are all mutants in mismatch repair system. You remember, mutase is coding, this gene is coding for the mismatch repair recognizing protein, and mutel is important because stabilizing interaction of mutase with DNA and then initiating the rest of repair. So what you see here, that all of those strong mutators are mismatch repair deficient mutants. Now, the problem with this is that we know from the lab and from theory that normally they arise with the frequencies which are 10 to minus 5. And find them in many bacterial populations with a frequency that can go up to 20%, even 100%. And now, this is not true only for the E. coli. People have found it in natural isolates of Neisseria meningitis, Streptococcus aureus, Haemophilus influenzae, anyway, many bacteria. And in most of the cases, and vast majority of cases, it's a mismatch repair deficient. Now, people have been trying to understand why over a decade or even more of intensive studies. So this is just a kind of summary of different results that people have accumulated doing the experimental evolution, doing theoretical modeling, or observing in nature. I'm not going to go in all the details, but we know now a lot how these mutated alleles are selected for. What's happening that simply because they generate mutation at high rate, when many different adaptive mutations are required to be acquired and generated in the same genome over a short period of time, then the mutators can do it faster. They are selected because. Then the nature of selective pressure. The stronger selective pressure, the higher probability that mutator alleles will be selected for. Population size, of course, because, I mean, whenever the adaptation is limited by supply of mutations, and this is also in function of population size, this is influencing the selection of mutating alleles. And so on. I will come back a little bit later to these different categories. And also, I will discuss a little bit on this mutator strength, because we have been concentrated for a long time on the stronger mutators, because it's easy to work with them. And I will discuss a little bit about other mutators. And then this is what Olivier Tenant did. He did the in silico modeling, what's happening when you increase recombination rate, who is winning, And in fact, I mean, you can ask him in details anyway, but what he observed is that if you compete high mutation rates and higher recombination rate, recombination rates are going to win because they produce genetic variability with lower effect on fitness. And then there are many models that have been trying to understand what's happening with migration, competition, environmental stability, and instability. But now, what's interesting here, I just want to discuss many things that are not necessarily published and discussed a lot. One question is why most of mutators in nature are mismatch repair deficient mutants? Why to ask this question at all? And the question is results simply from the fact that there are dozens and dozens and dozens of different genes whose inactivation can increase mutation rates. Most of those genes are coding for DNA repair enzymes. And so why we only find mismatch repair deficient mutants? So this is the question. Now, one of the answers is that mismatch repair system is not the DNA repair system. It's controlling fidelity of replication. It's eliminating undamaged bases which are not Watson and Crick. This is very important, because if you leave a DNA lesion, then it can be very deleterious, because it can be even lethal. So although the consequence of inactivation of some DNA in the repair system can be high mutation rates, they are never selected for. So finally, because some of replication errors that are fixed because mismatch repair system is not active can be even advantageous. So this is a reason why mismatch repair system are selected for. Another one which is also very neglected, it's another phenotype of mismatch repair. So I told you, the first one is that mismatch repair is controlling replication fidelity. But what is recognizing mismatch repair? Mismatches. And mismatches are generated also during another process, which is homologous recombination. Now, this is well known, very well known to the geneticists that are studying DNA repair, replication, recombination. But most of evolutionists and population biologists just neglecting this. Why this is important? So if you have, this is duplex DNA, and then you have DNA which is coming either from homologous chromosomes in eukaryotes, diploid eukaryotes, or during horizontal gene transfer from another bacterium. Those DNA sequences are practically never identical. So what's happening when the enzymes like RecA, which is catalyzing homologous pairing, which is RAD51 in eukaryotes, and when homologous sequences is found, then you have displacement in generation of this D loop, and then a pairing. So this is the minimum length that is about 30 nucleotides in bacteria, and about 300 nucleotides in eukaryotes of perfect identity. Now, when this heteroduplex DNA is generated, then you have elongation of heteroduplex, branch migration here. And what's happening, if DNA is not identical, you have mismatches, exactly the same as during DNA replication. Now, the very same enzymes recognize mismatches. Mutase recognized, mutase stabilized, and there is abortion of recombination intermediates. Now, this is very important because this is preventing genomic rearrangements also. It's not only that it's controlling horizontal gene transfer. And it's absolutely amazing and very important for the eukaryotes because this is a system which is controlling meiosis. So some of the mismatch repair homologs, mutase homologs, are involved in control of meiosis. And what is also amazing is that finally they are determining the speciation, because for the meiosis, you have to have a crossover. If you don't have a crossover, then you have don't have a correct segregation of chromosomes. So if you have a DNA sequence divergence over a certain level between the homologous chromosomes, then there is abortion of crossover and recombination, and you have sterility. And at least in yeast, it was clearly shown that this system is controlling speciation. If you abolish this system, then you have you can cross the yeast species that are normally sterile. Now there is yet another thing that I really want to underline here. So you have here mismatch. Mismatch is coming from the fact that two DNA sequences are not identical. And this is coming also something which is not enough appreciated. I discussed with Michael this last year, is that there is no such a thing as neutral mutation. Because if you have neutral mutation, for example, in this DNA, and it's neutral according to all criterion, whatever you try to measure the effect on fitness, it's perfectly neutral, but it's not neutral for recombination. There is no neutral mutation for the recombination. So there are no such things as a neutral mutation. This is one of the strongest phenotypes of neutral mutation. Why? Because you have the most mutation neutral, but in fact they have this phenotype. They are preventing genetic recombination. So this is the strongest phenotype. And the mismatch repair system is controlling this, acting on the pairing between the DNAs that are carrying neutral mutations. Now, why I'm telling all this? Because, and this is also a little bit neglected, that mismatch repair defective strain can hitchhike also on the events of horizontal gene transfer. So it's not only that they can hitchhike with the adaptive mutation they generate, but they are also even much more efficiently hitchhiking over horizontal gene transfer. And one of the reasons is that effect, anti-recombinogenic effects of a mismatch repair system is much stronger than anti-mutator effects of mismatch repair system. This is one. And second thing is that usually recombination is less deleterious than newly arisen mutation. Because finally, what is recombination doing is rearranging a mutation that already passed, most of them, not all, natural selection. Now, yes?
If you have two bases which don't match this Watson criteria, and if you have mutation in this mismatch repair, then what happens?
What happens? Then you have recombination. And this is what happened. Okay?
Or in just DNA replication, I meant they're left.
Oh, during DNA replication, if you have a mismatch, it's not repaired. The second round of replication is separating the two strands and fixing mutation. You want me to explain more details, or it's okay? Okay. Yes.
Recombination effect. Is that still true when you do a recombination over long piece? And then, of course, this one extra mutation is happening in the context of two strains that have anyway maybe some kind of variations. But so, I mean, this effect I can see for a single mutation that would be otherwise neutral. But is it still true, like in the context of recombining longer stretches?
Yes.
Of DNA?
But you know that. What is complicated in a way is that when you said longer stretches in DNA, for example, conjugation or transduction can transfer hundreds of kilobases or even megabases of DNA. But what's happening is that, so if the, you know, in bacteria, those that don't know bacteria, the genomes are circular, okay, and this is bacterial cell. So, and then if the big chunk of DNA is entering here, it can be hundreds of kilobases. This is what you're asking for. But what's happening is that you don't have a pairing which is long as the transfer segment. What's happening, you have invasion here, and you have invasion here. And then you have simply a replacement of this part of DNA. So finally, when I was, you know, trying to draw here, is zoom what's happening here and what's happening here. And even if this is 100 kilobases, 200 or megabase, you always only two small events. And you need only 30 nucleotides to initiate this on this side and this side. And then heteroduplex can go for about several 20, 30, 40 kilobases, and that's it. But then all this is not engaged in recombination. This is transduction and conjugation. During natural transformation, you have only small chunks of DNA. And then the whole DNA, the whole length of DNA, is a heteroduplex. And they are very small.
So Butes deficient strains would have no effect on those long...
Yes, they do.
But
they act here.
Right, but if you don't have a perfect 30 base match, it wouldn't happen at all, right? Or
yes, it wouldn't happen at all.
I see. And then, but if how long does it have to continue? I'm a little bit confused here because 30 bases you have to get from the very beginning, so mutase cannot really fix it. But then it can continue for a little bit, but not for the entire 10 kilobases.
As I told you, it's going up to 40, 50 kilobases.
Yes.
I mean, you, of course, from initiation you have something like this, the length of heteroduplex.
Okay.
But you know, it's probably about 10 kilobases, this part. And this is kind of elsewhere. This is what is happening, and this is happening during conjugational DNA transfer. Okay?
So it doesn't really matter how similar is this inserted piece to what you already have, if it's there.
The only thing what counts is what's with the ends. And in the between, you can have something, you know, alien DNA.
Yeah, okay. But then how does MUTS minus helps here? What if you have a MUTS deficient strain, what does it help?
Okay, so this is summary of many, many, many data.
Sorry.
Yes.
Does it have to be your hands or could it be your elbows, for example? Can you basically go and stick somewhere else?
You need end. There is no recombination without ends. Recombination is something which is not normal. You need broken DNA. And either you're broken in programmed way, like for example, Matic said type switching in yeast, and you have HO nuclease which is cutting DNA, or during meiosis you have also programmed double strand breakage, but it's programmed. Under the other situations, your combination is there to mend the broken ends. You need broken end.
So, in this mechanism, the genome size can vary as well, right?
Because of course, can... yeah. You can add the huge amounts of DNA or reduce the
yeah. That's not a constraint.
Yeah. I mean, in E. coli natural populations, there are variation of genome size. It can vary, you know, it can tolerate the big variations.
From 4 megabase to almost 6 megabase.
Yeah, it's huge.
I mean, the same species.
Yeah. So this is a summary of what many people did, and our lab contributed a lot to this. And just to illustrate this and transfer what Sergei asked me. So this is conjugational transfer from E. coli to different members of E. coli species or to Salmonella typhimurium. Salmonella typhimurium is about 20% diverged on DNA sequence level. 20% diverge, and then you have many things which are completely heterologous. And this is on log scale, recombination efficiency, and this is DNA sequence divergence. We can discuss if you need, what does it mean, but it's not important right now. I told you for this extreme is 20%. And what you see in wild type, there is this beautiful log linear relationship. And this is true also for eukaryotes. That means, when you have even a slight increase in the DNA sequence divergence, there is exponential decrease of recombination efficiency. So, for example, the efficiency of this type of a transfer, when the DNA is nearly identical, is, you, as you can see here, is in percentage. When you have a big divergence, you go down 4, 5, 6 order of magnitudes. You can say, okay, is this because you recombine DNA, as you asked, because you introduce something which is not, you know, which is deleterious for recipient cells or something like that. Maybe the cells are dead, whatever. But then, when you inactivated MUTES or MUTEL, and this is what you ask, you go nearly back completely.
So
you efface completely this the interspecies barrier to recombination. It's practically 99% of this, 90%, sorry, this is due to the mismatch repair. So the major barrier to recombination and gene exchange in this transition period towards further speciation is a mismatch repair, and yeast is the same, and probably in eukaryotes and mammals.
How does it actually do it? The 30 base thing aligns, and then the mismatch repair comes and fixes if there is a mismatch. Is it the 30 base pair or?
Okay.
So this is
zoom, either during transformation, or zoom in this when you have interaction between transfer DNA and recipient DNA. And the answer to your question, you need the end. And when the transfer DNA is transferred, you have an end, because DNA which enters is broken. Now you zoom this, and blue is donor DNA, and green is recipient DNA. So the very nature of genetic recombination in all living organisms is such that you need this initiation part.
Which is 30 is just the very beginning, right? This one.
This is in bacteria is about 30, and I told you in eukaryotes is about 300, and the very same proteins are doing this. I mean homologs. Now, if you have the difference in DNA sequence, although I mean they can be, as I told you, neutral mutation, but you have a mismatch because they are not the same anymore, and you can continue further, of course. I told you, this can continue up to 20, 30 kilobases. And so the probability is high that we'll encounter any other DNA sequence divergence. And this is substrate for mutase. And it blocks this recombination intermediate, and there is abortion.
So until what time, I guess my very original question, I don't understand, when should I worry about it beyond the initial 30 base pair? The abortion starts, this D loop continues for...
You don't have recombination with just 30 base pairs.
Yes, so you need...
I mean, the people have been looking for this, and then realized something like this. If this is, once again, this is the size of recombining segments. Can be shorter. No, it's not divergence, it's size.
Okay.
And then this is the recombination efficiency in log scale. It goes like this. Nucleotides. It's a log scale. Already here, it's practically not, it's zero.
And when does it saturate at one?
Sorry?
When does it saturate at 100% efficiency, or it doesn't?
Oh, it's 100%, depending on different systems of recombination. But that means you cannot have homologous recombination, which is catalyzed with enzymes like REC-A and RAD51 in eukaryotes, which is smaller than this, what is called by those people that invented this MEPS, minimal efficient processing segment. No recombination below, okay? And then you have, and this is log scale. I mean, you can go 7, 8, 9 orders of magnitude below. So it's non-existent practically. Unless, and then, this is when you have simply the length. But what if the length, you have a length, but the length is interacted with this type of structures, mismatches. Then mismatch repair intervenes.
I'm still confused about something, so. Let's go back to your one slice of this picture with mismatch repair. So if you don't have mismatch repair,
yes,
then you can just, it'll just...
You go on.
You go on and it's fine.
It's fine. Then you have resolvases, whatever you need for the maturation of recombination.
And you'll get recombination.
You have recombination, no problem.
No problem at all. And if you do have the mismatch repair enzymes there, then at some point, these sequences aren't identical, most likely. So
yes.
If it misses here, it'll just... It'll abort later and later, so you can get a whole spectrum of lengths that are...
Yeah, I mean, here you have also this low. You see, you can look for the slope. And then when you active mismatch repair, you change the slope here. And what's amazing is that when you overproduce mutel, this is overproduction, you go down, huge. I mean, this is something that people who've been thinking a little bit about mutation, accumulation of genetic variability due to this molecular system. Most of them, not all, of course, completely neglected this recombination stuff. It's very important. That's why it's important. Also because of this. Because people have been thinking, okay, you have now inactivation mismatch repair system, you generate now adaptive mutations by the phenomenon of hitchhiking, you can enrich these mutated alleles, and so what? You are dead in the end. Why? Because you start accumulating, when the selective pressure, now, in fact, deleterious mutations are not anymore counterbalanced by advantage of adaptive mutations, then the fitness is going down. And that's why, on the long term, people said, okay, your story, not only of our lab, but many labs, it's a dead end. But now many new things are coming out. For example, you can have very rapid reversion of mutator mutations. Now, it turned out that mutant gene, have a repetition inside the gene. And this repetition can, if you have small deletion, it's out, it's off, but you can have then restoration, reversion, and you go back. So you can modulate the efficiency. I mean, this is what this Chinese group published recently. I don't know, did you see? No, okay. But this is something which is very difficult to catch in the nature, especially. Because if you have functional gene, who knows, is it something that was inactivated before or not? But there is another nice story that we published a long time ago. It's based on this horizontal gene transfer. And there are data based on phylogenetic analysis of the genes, that in fact, that the very fact that when you are mismatch repair deficient mutants, this is increasing probability that you reacquire the functional allele of the same gene from another bacterium. And this is also lowering mutation rates. So these are two different mechanisms by which you can rapidly lower the mutation rate upon adaptation. Now, higher recombination rates, as I told you, in mismatch repair deficient mutants can be also advantageous for another reason. Because when you increase the gene flow by 100 or 1,000-fold in some cases, then you also can, by very virtue of this primitive sexuality, also eliminate the deleterious mutations. And this is something that I also want to underline, that people are completely neglecting the case of Helicobacter pylori. So this is bacteria that half of us have in our stomach. And these bacterial species are natural mismatch repair deficient mutant and have incredibly high mutation rates. And now, and they have relatively small population size in our stomach. Now, how comes that they don't disappear? And I'm arguing that because they have incredibly high recombination rates. So they are completely panmictic. So the combination of high mutation rates and high recombination rates can allow finally high mutation rates to persist.
So yes? And this Helicobacter, the genetic basis of the mutators is what, mutase minus?
Nobody restored mismatch repair proficiency. But they are mismatch repair deficient natural mutants. And they have very high mutation rates.
I have in my hand, there is some linkage between the mutase and the RPOS, the stress.
Oh, yeah, but this is in, yeah, of course.
What are you going to do with that?
I don't think this is the case of pylori. Yes?
Are there other mechanisms of recombination?
Of course, there are dozens and dozens of dozens of different enzymes that are involved in control of recombination. The problem being, as I told you, for the mutation rates and DNA repair, is that if you inactivate some genes that are controlling recombination, most of the time the cells are sick. Because the primary reason, probably, during evolution, probably, you know, for the recombination is DNA repair. If you have broken DNA, there's no other way to repair it unless you recombine it. So, and then most of the time, hyper-recombinogenic phenotypes are due to the inactivation of some important functions. and population of mismatch, population of genes that are coding for some important recombination functions, you have always a lot of dead cells. While once again, mismatch repair system is not, of course, controlling recombination between identical sequences, which is important, for example, for repair, but it's preventing genomic rearrangements and gene flow between different genomes. And per se, I mean, when you take the mismatch repair deficient bacterial population, you don't see the dead cells because the little mutations are very rare. Okay, so let's move on. Now, we have been discussing, I simply wanted just to zoom in on some aspects of this story ongoing, and it's now the whole story, that they are not discussed enough or appreciated enough. Now, I would like now to just a little bit discuss this mutator strength. As you remember, you know, we have been concentrating ourselves on these guys for simple reasons, because they're mutating so much that it's so easy to work with them and do many, many experiments. But as you can see, you have the others, and they are not mismatch repair deficient mutants. And so, what are they? I mean, the strong, the old strong mutators strains are the mutants of genes that are involved in, as I told you, in control of fidelity DNA replication. Most of them, the vast majority of them, mismatch repair deficient mutants. Now, what about those, what I call them weak mutators? They are, you know, they are mutated much less. Now, of course, they are producing less adaptive mutations, but they are also producing less deleterious mutation. And can then also contribute to adaptation. Now, I give you a few examples. One is from Darwin Hughes' lab. What he did, this is E. coli, different laboratory strains, and they very precise. They have very precise inactivation of genes, so they're perfectly isogenic, but they have different mutation rates. It goes from 2-fold, 3-fold, up to, this is mismatch repair deficient mutants. In his hands, it's going to nearly 1,000-fold. Okay? So what he did, he put the strains in solution with the one antibiotic, which is fluoroquinolone. Fluoroquinolone is inhibiting DNA gyrase, breaking DNA, and killing cells. So he started with small concentration, then simply diluted to higher concentration, and higher, and higher, and higher. And he was looking how high he can go up, and then noting when the half of his lineage is dead. And what he obtained, it's orders of magnitude increase of resistance to these fluoroquinolones, starting from the ancestral strain. But what he observed, well, there is a beautiful correlation between mutation rates and capacity to resist under this regime and this experimental setup. Now, what was interesting for me is that although we have been concentrating all on these guys, in fact, those guys that mutated 2, 5, 10-fold more than ancestral strain, they also can improve, in fact, they contribute to increased resistance for the order magnitudes. So the weak mutators can do the job also. And the price is lower mutation rates, lower production of deleterious mutations and lower mutation rates compared to these guys. Now, this is in the lab. Now, we wanted to see, is it this true in the nature? Do you, in the nature, now have this beautiful correlation between antibiotic resistance and mutation rates? Now, for this, we took many, many natural isolates, and especially natural isolates of E. coli that have many resistances. So this is biased. Taking strains that have many resistances and then ask, are you mutated or not? And the idea is to test at that time, oh, wow, can we see this beautiful correlation also with this really natural isolates? And the answer was no. I mean, first of all, I just would like to show you that it was not just one antibiotic, two antibiotics. It was 33 different antibiotics for 300 strains, and we knew exactly, is it resistant, intermediate, or sensitive strains. and then we analyze all this and try to see, is there a correlation between number of resistances and mutation rates? And there was a lot of noise. That's why we were obliged to smoothen the data. So here you have the data of mutation rates were ordered, low mutating and high mutating. And then we organized the data, so using cumulative sum. And why this was very useful is that we obtained the breakpoints here and here. And then we asked, are these guys different from these guys, this guy from these guys? And what we observed was interesting in a way. Instead, as in the lab, that you continue to go up. So you have low mutation rates, intermediate, and then you expect to go on. But in fact, they are down. So the conclusion of this is that E. coli strains that have many antibiotic resistance are overrepresented among strains having intermediate mutation rates, not the strongest. And also that even modest modification mutation rates can influence the evolution of antibiotic resistance. Now, antibiotic resistance for us, there is evident medical interest of this. But for us, it's selective pressure as any other selective pressure. So it was just convenient to use antibiotic resistance as a phenotype. Now, talking about selection of these weak mutators, there is yet another study. I didn't probably, some of those have read this. It's amazing. It's Larry Robb, who was studying for different genes mutation rates. And what he did, he constructed 66 different mutants of polymerase 1. Polymerase 1 in E. coli is that polymerase which is synthesizes Okazaki fragments. It's important for replication. Now, the genomes of those mutants were perfectly isogenic. Only one small polymerase was mutated. And what he did, what he obtained, that those polymerases, those mutants, have huge range of mutation rates, spontaneous mutation rates. So this is the normal initial strain, then many, many anti-mutators, and also then mutators that mutate fivefold, tenfold, hundredfold, or thousandfold more than wild type. And this is unique experiments. He mixed 66 mutants together and subcultured them for 1 month, different media. And what he obtained here, after 1 month of competition, was this distribution. In fact, under those conditions, the winners are intermediate mutators. So as you can see here, those peaks, so it's 10-fold mutators, and you have a little bit 20-fold mutators. So this is distribution of what he obtained. So the weak mutators are winners.
So why on earth is the wild-type mutation rate?
Okay, so what is wild-type mutation rate? That's a good question. Yeah, definitely. And it is true that in all lab strains, they have this mutation rate. But whenever you give them an opportunity or impose selection, then you increase mutation rates. But if you take, depending on many different experiments, if you take a pure mutator, for example, this is what the German guy, what was his name, Trubner, he did, put in a chemostat a mutator, and then after 2,000 generations, what he observed was lowering mutation rates back. But now, the take-home message from this one, these weak mutators and intermediate mutators are something that we kind of a little bit neglected because we have been blinded by this effect of those strong mutators. But in nature, those small guys, they have an advantage, yes.
So those mutations, do they have no direct effect on fitness?
These mutations here.
This is a DNA polymerase.
Yes. No, they don't have an effect on fitness.
This balance should depend on how dynamic the environment is, right?
Oh, definitely.
How much new selection you present on them.
Definitely. It's all depends on the environment. I agree. In different environments, you can have different outcome. That's why, for example, he didn't select for the mismatch repair deficient mutators. And you go in lungs of cystic fibrosis, patients, and you go 20-30% are mismatch repair deficient mutations. So depending, and then that's why all different on this list that I put, you know, I didn't discuss this environmental, ecological components, competition, migrations, stability and instability. And this is all this, you know, intervening in selection and kind of tuning of mutation rates.
Has it been shown that if you make, for example, the environment changing more so that you have more opportunities for positive selection, that the
people did this mostly with by modeling?
Or with antibiotics also.
Antibiotics, yes.
Miller, after few rounds of change of antibiotic, you've 100% mutators, the strongest you can get.
Yeah.
So that's very easy to get.
We take what he said, you plate on one antibiotic, then another, and then you finish 100% of mutators.
Oh, yeah, I'm somehow not doubting it, but it's not clear whether that's sustainable, right? Mm-hmm. That's a short-term experiment.
So
but
there's...
Because the disadvantage in this compromise, the disadvantage in the deleterious mutation, that plays out on slightly longer timescales.
Yes, so, you have all these models by Gerisch, where they show that actually the benefit of beneficial mutation is short term compared to the cost, and so that you could go to ever increasing mutation rate and eventually go to extinction because of that, because it's always beneficial. I think they have also new experiments in which they show that you can select for a mutator, but if you put in an even stronger mutator, you select for the even stronger mutator in the short term, which in the long term would. We don't find a really high. The cost, we see the cost we see it when you increase mutation rate about 10,000 fold.
Yes.
Then you start seeing weird colony shapes and having dead cells and everything. Mm. But before, we don't see that.
You don't see it.
And just another point, in Lenski's experiments, he evolved lines for 50,000 generations since 88 up to now. And out of 12 lines, 4 or 5 became mutators.
Seven. Up to today, there are seven.
Up to today, okay.
And, they will finish all mutators.
We sequence a bunch of these populations. And we can see fluctuations. So the increase in mutation rate, actually the mutee population, at least two are mutee, so high increase in mutation rate. And then we select for decrease in mutation rate later on. So early in the stage, we find a large increase, like 300-fold increase in mutation, but then it slows down. And
this is what Ferenczi observed in mutee. Ferenczi.
Yeah, in mutee.
You're saying this mutation, high mutation, is a transitory effect.
Yeah, the transitory, they tend to reduce after. And here we really control environment. Nothing new can come, and there's no such thing as proper genes, functional genes that can come up and restore a functional copy. But even though we have inactivated the mutee, and then we find that the mutation rate is decreasing after an initial increase, slowly it's decreasing. In some cases, we have clearly the mechanism, we find exactly the gene involved, we know, like MUT1 can compensate the effect of MUT. In other cases, it's not clear, we have mutation elsewhere in some repair system, and then the genome are loaded with, they have hundreds of mutations, so there's lots of potential mutations. But we clearly see a pattern where the transient increase in mutation and then a decrease.
And there is a way out of this vicious cycle.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are there regulatory systems that can down-regulate?
Yeah, I will come to this. Exactly. Okay. So, exactly. So, this is the answer to your question. So, we don't know exactly. We don't know. What are the molecular mechanisms that are responsible for this? You can call them weak, intermediate mutators anyway. They are not mismatch repair deficient mutants, definitely. Now, the answers is in the next 20 minutes or so. I will just present yet another experimental setup. For many years, we have been interested in what's happening with the bacterial colony. I mean, we are all using bacteria, and we all know what are the colonies. But colonies, per se, are absolutely fascinating structures. I mean, finally, bacteria in nature, they live in structured environments. Microcolonies or biofilms, whatever, they are never in liquid cultures, well-shaken, stable environments. And the beauty of bacterial colonies is that you start with one cell, you finish with 10 to 7, 10 to 8, 10 to 9 cells, depending. And then what's happening, they stop growing, most of the cell, they slow down the growth, and then what's happening over time, you have the gradients of pH, oxygen, nutrients, and then it's a mess what's happening inside. And we really wanted to understand what's happening. And as I told you, when they grow up, after 1 or 2 days, they slow down considerably growth. And so we wanted to learn more about it, just pure curiosity of a naturalist, biologist. And that's why we also chosen one particular regulon, which is involved in control of metabolism of those cells that are in near dormancy or slow down growing. And this is RPOS regulon. So the RPOS regulon, it's also called general stress response, is present in many bacteria, not all, many, but our model is E. coli. So what's happening, you have a gene, RPOS, which is coding for one subunit of RNA polymerase, which is called sigma. And there are many sigmas. And then most of them, they respond to different stresses and then simply induce the expression of different genes. And this particular gene is tightly controlled on different levels. So you have a control on the transcription level, then messenger RNA can be also sequestered or liberated in order to be available, you know, for the synthesis of a protein. And then protein is shepherded by this protein to the proteolysis. Now, on all these different levels of control, in fact, you may have some environmental stimuli which is intervening. Reduced growth rate, which is happening in colonies, is the lockdown. High cell density, which is colony. Oxidative stress, low temperature, high osmolarity, low pH, carbon starvation, high temperature. They all intervene on in different levels. And now what's happening is that when you have induction, and then you don't have any more proteolysis, you have induction about hundreds of genes. And you have roughly three categories of phenotypes. One is total metabolic readjustment. One is modification of cellular envelope and cellular morphology. They are not rods, they are nearly round. They stop growing. And what is very important is they are resistant. They enter in multi-resistant state. They are resistant to heat shock, oxidative stress, osmotic shock, low pH UV, alkalinity aging, and so on. So E. coli is not sporulating, but can enter in something which is multi-resistant, not as spores, but they are very, very resistant. Now, as I told you, when you have induction of this, for example, when you don't have RSSB, you are very, very resistant. But you have a price for this, for example. If you inactivate RSSB gene, that means you are continuously induced for this response, and you put in competition with the wild type, either in minimal media or LD, over a certain number of generations, those that have constitutive expression of RPS regulon, they lose. So you cannot, in the same time, be very resistant to different stresses and to grow fast. You have to choose. And this is amazing. This is also conserved in all other microbes. For example, David Botstein observed this for Saccharomyces cerevisiae. There is clearly a trade-off between stress resistance and growth. Now, but there is this aspect, as I told you. For example, if you take RPS mutant, no response, wild type, or RSSB, you have constitutive response. Okay, you have three situations. You have different stresses, heat shock, oxidative stress, osmotic shock, and then you see that in function of induction of this regulon, you have stronger and stronger protection against different stresses. They are clearly multi-resistant from the exogenous stresses. But even from endogenous stresses, we measured endogenous stress by using one dye which is reacting to a reactive oxygen species within the cells. So wild type, you see, they are inside the cell, you don't see green fluorescence, only in periplasm. But when you are when you are RPS minus cells, they're all full of reactive oxygen species. So this is not only protecting you against exogenous stresses, but also it's also dealing with endogenous stresses. It's very important. Now, we are not going to go into detail, so we have been interesting in order to see what's happening in those colonies in RPS deficient strain and wild type strain. So we did transcriptome analysis over time, exponential growth, and day one old coronis and day seven, and then you obtain something like this. We are not going to enter details, but this allows us to identify what's happening. For example, just to show you, these are RPS-dependent genes, but then when we zoomed to the genes that are coding for ribosomes, when you look in wild type, so this is day seven over day one, you see that all those genes are repressed. So of course, in wild type, in all those host colonies, more and more and more cells stop growing, and they enter in dormancy. They are not synthesizing massively proteins. But when you look at day seven colonies, so this is RPS over wild type, you see the RPS, they are not obeying to the program of dormancy. They are active. So this is clearly a signal that there is a lot of protein synthesis in RPS cells, although you have very old colonies. Now we wanted also to learn more of what's happening inside. And in this, among different genes that are induced under those conditions, we identify two. Now, why the transcriptomes are problematic in a way? Because you see, this is very strongly induced. This is induction. But then you don't know, is it very strongly induced in subpopulation of cells, or all cells are induced? So the transcript analysis like this is just indication that you have to go and learn a little bit more about this. So what we did, we took those two genes, fused the resulting proteins with fluorescent proteins, and then you just take the colony, then you can cut it out by confocal microscope. That means you go and then you look inside. And when you do this, and so what we are going to see is from top, this is what you observe. The colonies are not homogeneous. Those guys are induced in spots. When you zoom to one, then you see beautiful things. So those two genes that are very strongly induced, this one, they are dormant cells, which are pink here, and another gene which is strongly induced is induced only in these islands. And in the middle, we have a special dye which is dead in dead cells. So you have dead cells, and then the shape of those cells are suggesting that maybe they are growing. They're probably then eating the nutrients that realize from the dead cells. And in order to see whether those cells are growing, what we did, we used one genetic trick. And that means we had the mutant of DNA polymerase, which is when the DNA is synthesized, when you shift the temperature, then you inhibit DNA replication and cells start filamenting. So it was possible with this trick to find the cells within the colony that are growing and those that are not growing. So you see those cells, all those cells are not growing. And then we saw those that are growing. Yes, indeed. So within the colony, you have some cells that are not obeying anymore to the program of dormancy. They start growing. And the indication is that they use nutrients from dead cells. Now, is it regulation or are those mutants? And this is suggesting that they are probably mutants. So we used mismatch repair deficient mutant just to have more mutations now. And then ask, do we have more islands? And so these are different diets. I'm not going to go into details. But this is wild type, and this is mismatch repair deficient mutants. That means the origin of those islands were mutational events. They are mutants. Yes?
How long does it take to see them then? How many cell divisions?
Oh, you can, after a few days, you can see them. I mean, because with the confocal microscope, you can go down to the single cell. But when you have a single cell, you don't know, is it single cell or it's future island? So eventually you can do the film and then you can go back over days and then go back to the, I mean, you need to have a group of cells to be sure that it's island. And
say over one day that we are used to seeing colonies,
do you see? Oh, no, this is, okay. You start seeing them after 3-4 days.
Okay.
Because, I mean, what's happening is there are mutants that are waiting that microenvironmental conditions change. The right combination of pH, oxygen, and nutrients and then they start. They are waiting, they are there. And you see this because in mutants minus background, you have all mutants that you can imagine in one population. So they are waiting, and then one. Okay. Now, why I'm telling all this? It's not only because it's beautiful to see, but also we try to learn more about those variants. So we isolated some of those variants after several weeks in colonies and measured the fitness, stress resistance, nutrition competence, and mutation frequency. When I say nutritional competence, it's their capacity to use different type of nutrients, especially very low concentration of nutrients, and then compared with the ancestor strain. Now, this is one observation, and it was very curious for us. That means, first of all, these are different strains. This is ancestral. This is RPA minus as control. And then you try to measure resistance to hydrogen peroxide. And you see that, at least here, most of them are very sensitive, more sensitive than ancestral strain. So they are more sensitive. This is resistance. And then, completely independently, it's not the result as treatment with H2O2, but just measured mutation, capacity to generate mutations. And we observed this correlation, which was very unusual. Because down there, you have RPOS minus mutant, and we found two variants, of which one was RPOS minus mutant, and one was attenuated. That means have less RPOS protein per cell. Now, this is something strange, because you expect cells that are more sensitive to different stresses. So they have more, you remember, more reactive oxygen species, many things are happening. You expect them to have high mutation rates, but they have low mutation rates. So why? We try to look at the list of genes that are controlled by RPOS. So in fact, what's happening concerning this part of DNA repair and stress resistance, you have those few big categories. First one is protection and repair of oxidative damage. So you have catalases, superoxide dismutases, and so on, the protection, they are all reduced. Then you have one which is very interesting is that it's one DNA polymerase which is involved in damage tolerance. Because sometimes you have DNA lesion which is blocking replication, and if it's not repaired and replication is blocked, this cell is dead. So you have these specialized polymerases that can allow replication to go over lesion. But the price to be paid for this are mutations. And this polymerase is induced. This can be source of mutations. And then yet another very important source of damages is alkylation. And you have induction and repression of some of those genes coding for those function. And which was very interesting is that our old friends, mismatch repair proteins, are repressed. That means when you induce RPOS, you repress mismatch repair. So you may say, so what? I mean, if you enter a stationary phase, you are not replicating DNA anymore, so you don't need these proteins which are controlling the fidelity of DNA replication. But things are not that simple. Now, first of all, we try to see, is it really happening this? That means we measure efficiency of repair of mismatches that we introduced artificially in cells during the growth. So this is growth of a cell, and this is efficiency of the repair. And in fact, this is the percentage of unrepaired heteroduplex molecule. So more you grow, more you have unrepaired. And this is the result of downregulation of mismatch repair. And we know because we try to complement these cells. So this is the wild type. When you overproduce mutant protein, it's changing absolutely nothing. And you remember what is repressed when RPS induced is mutase gene. When you do this, then you go down. So this is showing that mismatch repair capacity is diminishing with when you enter stationary phase. But this is exactly what I told you, when you don't have really DNA replication anymore. So we decided to do something else. We tried to stress the cells with very low doses of antibiotic. So they continue to grow. And we measured, first of all, that this is really inducing also RPS regulon, because this is imposing stress. So we use just small concentration of ampicillin, and then this is without and this is with ampicillin. You have fivefold increase here in mutations. Okay, so ampicillin is mutator, we know that, but nobody knew that it is because of induction of RPS. So when we inactivated RPS gene, there was no difference without or with ampicillin. Now, what about mismatch repair? We did exactly the same thing. We overproduced ID mutel and mutase. Okay. And this is what we observed. So this is mutel overproduction without ampicillin and with ampicillin. We observed increase. When you overproduce mutase, then you don't see any more difference with or without ampicillin. So this is suggesting that now it's not stationary phase. It's simply growing under stressful conditions. You have induction of RPS, and you downregulate mismatch repair. And because of this, you have high mutation rates. And as I told you, remember, we were looking for those weak mutators. The factors you have here are about fivefold, those weak mutators. Now, I'm closing my talk. Just I give you one example. We characterized at least one variant that emerged in this colony. So this guy had deletion of one chunk of a chromosome, which was initiated by insertion sequence. But what is important is that what was deleted was this gene. And this gene is coding for the protein CRE, which binds to RPS, activating expression of RPS-regulated genes. So when you lose this, what's happening is that what we observe that you have less messenger RNA or RPS and less RPS. And the consequence is they can use, this thing can use more carbon sources. This is very important. This is probably selection for those mutants. They are better. They grow better under those conditions. But they are more sensitive to oxidative osmotic shocks and low pH. They have more mutase and mutel messenger RNA and have low mutation rates. So this is absolutely fitting what we saw before. Now, we wanted to ask natural isolates, is it true that a cellular amount of RPS is really involved in regulation of your mutation rates? And we took 30 natural isolates, measured the intercellular concentration of RPS and mutation rates, and there was rather good correlation. The answer is yes. Now, how to summarize all this? In fact, it is clear, and this is what Tom Ferenczi discussed a lot, is that, I mean, he studied these two aspects. That means, and I told David Boston for yeast, in fact, your nutritional competence and your stress resistance, they don't go together. You simply cannot grow under the conditions when you have very low concentration nutrients or very rare nutrients and be resistance to stresses like oxidative stress, thermic stress. There is always the trade-off. If you good in growth under those conditions, you must be sensitive to stresses. When you are very resistant to stresses, you grow very, very slowly. Now, of course, what's happening in real life is continuously oscillating between those different conditions. And now microcolony also, you have micro changes. That's why different variants that are here or here or here are selected for. Now, how this is regulated? In this case, it's RPS. That means there is a selective pressure which is acting either here and here and selecting the mutants that have different level of RPS. And we know, and now this is secondary mechanism and consequence, that consequently you have also modulation and mutation rates. That means that you have selective pressure which is acting here, and as a consequence you have modulation mutation rates. And now, it's not probably coincidence, when you have very stressful life conditions, you have also higher mutation rates. Now, it's clear clear, and we know from different studies, the trade-offs are essential to generation and maintenance of diversity. And now we see that these different trade-offs are also involved in the regulation mutation rates. Now I will stop here, just with this summary, that I think that these small modulation mutation rates result from the fine-tuning of this pleiotropic genetic network that optimize survival strategies in different ecological niches. And this is what we, when we studied a long time ago, induction of mutations under stressful conditions among many natural isolates, we found that this corresponds more, in fact, to the lifestyle of a strain than to the phylogeny, for example, of a strain. Now I'm going to stop here just to mention two people who are actually working on this right now. So Claude Sandroof, which is studying these colonies, and Arnaud Guitares, who is studying involvement of RPS in mutagenesis. Thank you very much for your attention.
So in this last slide, you're saying it's basically that, are you saying that the variation in mutation rate are more or less a byproduct of this trade-off between stress and nutritional?
This is probably what's happening. I mean, it needs some modeling, of course. But I think this correlation between cellular amount of RPS and mutation rates is probably the secondary consequence of this. But what I think is, independently, finally, what is selective pressure, which is acting mutation on alleles that are regulating mutation rates? You generate mutations that they are then subject to natural selection. So I think that those small modulations are more involved in this game than what's happening with the strong mutators, which are really, you have hitchhiking phenomenon. Yes?
For the speed mutators, do you expect to see also a aesthetic effect, like economic aesthetic effect, if you look at the weak mutators? Having two weak mutators have the same effect as one weak mutator. And that's my expectation.
You wanted to say something?
Sure. So seeing an aesthetic effect between the weak mutators, basically, in one genome.
I don't know, but the problem is that when you take different weak mutators, between different weak mutators, they also have here, they have also different, stress resistance and nutritional competence. There are many parameters that are changing continuously and simultaneously, so it's very difficult.
How is the genomic variance actually to give rise to these weak mutators? Is one gene that is
Oh yeah, I mean, what's absolutely amazing is that, and this what we know from many experiments, and especially Tom Ferenczi, he did many experimental evolution in chemostats. It's never RPS gene, nearly never. It's always regulation. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, if you need to inactivate this guy in order to be better grower, he was doing competition in chemostats with very low concentration of glucose in mineral media. And I mean, you can obtain this by inactivating the RPOS, and it's happening.
It does happen.
It's very rare.
There's some insertion sequence in RPOS, but the mutational target is huge. There's many ways to enter this network. So, and genes, maybe I'll present some stuff on that. Maybe.
Okay.
The network is huge. We have genes that we see all the phenotypes linked to RPOS. We sequence the whole genome. We find a mutation in a gene. We have no idea, it's never been described as being involved in any way.
Yeah.
When we do the knockout in some strain, we find it's correlated. So it's a cascade of
stuff. Yeah, like here, for example.
Yeah.
This is completely modifying the cellular amount of... it's even worse. It's not changing the cellular amount of RPS. It's changing the profile of RPS repressed genes or expressed genes.
How long does it take in this balance to say if you introduce the stress, then it has to go from a more
to
the other one. So how fast are then?
So you have two levels, of course, because this is regulated system. It's immediate. The response is immediate if you impose a stress. And this is really something that you can go on and off, off and on. It's regulated. But then, under some environmental conditions, for example, growth under very low concentration of carbon source, then you instead of, you know, start regulating this, you have mutational events that are regulating this. It's not, you know, and it's happening very, very frequently. And this is what is happening also in these columns.
And because the mutational target seems so big, the response can be very fast because you have plenty of mutants around just waiting. So
it's basically in standing variation. Or...
Yeah.
Yes. And also, what's amazing, what Tom Ferenczi observed is, so he used different strains that have different levels of RPS initially in the cell. And what he observed when he put them in chemostats, those that have higher amounts of RPS, they lose it more faster than those they have lower. So there is really inverse correlation. Yes?
You isolate natural strains. Is there a high variability of mutation rates?
Yes.
Yes, within one location where you isolate.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It can be very, very big variations. And I mean, you can... the people that studied this in more details are those that are studying, for example, Pseudomonas aeruginosa from lungs of cystic fibrosis. So you have different isolates from the same lung, and you have huge variation in mutation rates. I mean, E. coli, the problem is E. coli, you have huge population size, and then, you know, normally you don't isolate many, many, many different strains from the same environment. And there's a lot of migration in the guts. But for example, in lungs or some close infections, you don't have that many migration, and yet you have a huge diversity mutation rates. And it's clear, for example, in lungs of cystic fibrosis, whatever bacterium people looked, they found very strong mutators, and there is excellent correlation between antibiotic resistance and high mutation rates. And why those very strong mutations have been found? It's probably you have limited competition for two reasons. One is that lungs per se, it's not the place where you have a big passage of bacteria. And second, you have structure. That means the lungs are structured, and if you have bacterial population here, they are not competing with the others which are here. While in the gut, you have a big turnover. And so you can really have those strains that have high mutation rates for a long time, for the decades, when they hyper-specialize for a given environment, and if they don't have to move to another environment, they are there and then dominate. If they have to move, then we have an impression that it's what's happening with those intermediate mutations that are favored. So it all depends on environmental conditions and pressures. Yes?
So you're basically saying that in different environments, different things happen, but eventually, or in the end, what one sees is some correlation between low growth and high mutation rate.
Yes. This in many microbes, this is what people observe. And this is especially true for E. coli. I mean, especially because people mostly studied E. coli.
Yeah.
But it is true, I said several times, for yeast also. Yes?
When you grow a colony, you said it gets messy.
Yes.
It gets messy precisely because of that, because you get a number of mutators and five different niches.
Yes.
It's not from regulation to stress.
No, but it's amazing that in colony you select for mutants,
yeah.
Regulatory mutants.
Sometimes people invoke quorum sensing as an explanation for why you get heterogeneity.
Oh, yeah, but heterogeneity, you have phenotypic heterogeneity, which is based on regulation, of course, definitely, I agree. And then you have this, which is based on genetic variability. And those two phenomena are linked like this. And it may depend on bacterial species, environmental conditions, and quorum sensing. I mean, I didn't want to go into details, but in this also, it seems that some kind of quorum sensing is also involved. Because in a way, cells must feel what's happening in their environment. And it's a little bit involved also in this. A special type of quorum sensing, which is one molecule I'm not going to enter in detail, is indole. Yes?
Target for the strong mutators is presumably much smaller than the weak mutators, right?
If you think about mismatch repair deficient mutants, yes. But if you think about all possible genes whose inactivation is giving high mutation rates, then no. You have many, dozens and dozens and dozens of them. But simply, the consequence of inactivation of those genes is deleterious, so they are never selected for. Or in some particular conditions, like Lenski experiment, that he found mutant mutators.
Can the bacteria start from this weak mutators, which are easier to make, and then make this mismatch repair mutators, basically the strong mutators, just because the mutation rate is higher?
Why not?
Higher.
Of course. I mean, depending on selective pressure. If you increase selective pressure, and then especially if you put particular type of selective pressures, like what we mentioned before, for example, very strong selection, which is like antibiotic resistance, then you have one selection, second selection, and third one, you finish with nearly 100% of strong mutators. And it's not unlikely that weak mutator will finish faster to generate those mismatch repair deficient mutants. Because finally, what's happening is you act on pre-existing genetic variability. If your initial genetic variability is higher, then you have more than already in your starting population. Yes?
In some lineages in experimental evolution, we get mutes and mutee mutators, because once you one or the other, it's easier to inactivate the other gene also. So that's...
Yes. I mentioned mutee, remember. It's potentially interesting one, because it's removing atoxoguanin from pool of nucleotides, okay? But atoxoguanin can be incorporated in DNA, but also in RNA. So you may have effects on the transcription of translation, not only on replication. And it's complicated. So you can have phenotypic mutators and genetic mutators in the same cell because of the same genetic defect.
Thank you.